this is Ron Horshefsky, the CEO of Concord Orthopedics. I am joined today by Dr. Stephen Fox, Dr. Jeffrey Wiley, and Dr. Neil Dion, all of whom are fellowship-trained joint replacement specialists at Concord Orthopedics. Also, we are joined by Vicki Ribsom, who serves as the nurse navigator, assisting our patients through the process of having total joint replacement surgery. Today, our team is going to talk to you about what you can do to limit your chance of complications when you undergo both total knee replacement and total hip replacement surgery. Dr. Fox, what are some of the risks associated with having these surgeries?
Well, we have to understand this is major surgery, and I think that the biggest issues that we see are infection, blood clots, and in some cases, poor wound healing. And I think we've identified several factors that play into that, including obesity and smoking. Those are very key points, and we spent a great deal of our time trying to optimize those risks.
Dr. Wiley, can you talk to us a little bit about obesity and how it impacts total joint surgery?
Studies suggest that patients who are obese or super obese with a body mass index of over certainly 45 and even 40 are at markedly increased risk of complications, particularly infection, wound healing problems, as Dr. Fox mentioned, and then other things related to the surgery itself with increased rates of dislocation. And these all have varying associations with obesity. There's less blood flow to the wound, patients' body positions move during surgery to perhaps result in increased risk of dislocation where the components are not where we think they are just because of the size of the patient moves. It's more difficult to manage them in the operating room. Obesity can lead to more difficult situations with anesthesia as far as their oxygenation level and more challenges in that. This is something that we all can control. It's interesting in that patients, you know, I see patients every day who are dealing with these issues. It's very common. And patients have success in modifying their weight and addressing this issue. And it's not so much with exercise that I see patients have success with this. It's really diet and lifestyle modification. You know, patients with a severely arthritic knee or severely arthritic hip, there are limitations in what types of exercise that they can do. Of course, any amount of exercise is helpful, but it's really diet and lifestyle modification. And it comes down to the common philosophy is that I've seen patients have success with is eliminating the empty calories of carbohydrates and focusing more on lean protein. So eliminating, not eating breads, rice, pasta, potatoes, cereals, desserts, sweets, sandwiches with bread, pizza, those type of things, and focusing more on lean proteins. And with portion control, the size of the protein should be about the size of our palm. Green vegetables and beverages are a source of many hidden calories for us. So water is really the key thing from a beverage standpoint. So eliminating soda, diet sodas. Studies are now showing in medicine that diet drinks, we think we're doing ourselves a favor by drinking diet soda, that they're actually causing us to gain weight and have diabetes. Beverages are key. No alcohol. Coffee or tea, if you drink coffee or tea, try to eliminate the sweeteners or artificial sweeteners or creamers. Those just turn it into a milkshake, and that's why it tastes so good. Other things that have been successful for patients are not eating after supper. So once you eat, don't eat past that. And there are a variety of programs that can help. A variety of hospitals have nutrition programs that can be helpful. Weight Watchers has an app for our smartphones now, which recently I've seen patients have great success with. And then there are do-it-yourself programs. You could pick up various books at your local bookstore or online, like the South Beach Diet. There's a book called Wheat Belly. There's a book called The No Sugar Diet. And all these things are ways that espouse that same philosophy and patients have success. Another risk factor is malnutrition, in which we don't have the protein in our system to allow our wounds to heal satisfactorily. And interestingly, oftentimes patients who are obese are malnourished because it's just the wrong type of foods that we're eating.
Thank you.
Ron, I guess I'd like to go back to one thing about the reason that we're so concerned that, as Dr. Fox mentioned, the risk of infection and wound healing problems, why we're trying to address that. It's very different than just having a scratch on your hand or a hangnail or something, a scratch from a bush that your doctor or primary care person can treat with some local wound care and some antibiotics to make a small superficial infection go away. When there's an infection with an artificial joint, it's a major situation. we can't just give you typically antibiotics to make it go away if it's involving the artificial joint itself. Because what happens is the bacteria, which cause the infection, they stick to the metal and plastic pieces, which make up an artificial joint. And so our body just doesn't have a way to get the antibiotics to the bacteria to kill the bacteria and solve the and address the infection. So it typically, you know, if an infection occurs with an artificial joint, it typically is a situation where further surgery often is required, intravenous antibiotics for months, and oftentimes it requires us to remove the artificial joint from the bone. So patients can then be left without a fully functional hip joint or knee joint, which, as you can imagine, makes it very difficult to get around. Often we can put a temporary joint in, but it's just not a normal functional joint that you can't walk normally with. And so hopefully then, if it's been treated appropriately with the antibiotics, the surgery, the temporary joint, then hopefully months later, if it's been treated adequately, we could go back and put a new joint back in. So that's the reason we're so concerned about preventing infection and wound healing problems.
Okay, great. Dr. Dion, can you talk to us a little bit about why it's so important for somebody to stop smoking before they have the surgery?
Absolutely, Ron. So smoking is a risk factor that fortunately we have seen decrease over time, but still does exist. A lot of patients think that smoking is only going to affect their lung or their pulmonary status, which is certainly true, and that's one of the ways that smoking can increase your risk with surgery. However, we've learned over time that smoking also affects our small blood vessels and the biology that happens there, and so it will negatively impact wound healing for patients, and associated with this, there is a significant increase in infection for patients who are still smoking. The good news is that stopping smoking for even 4 weeks can significantly decrease the odds of a complication for patients who have smoked before. And so that is something that we wholeheartedly endorse for our patients, to make this surgery as safe as possible for them. As Dr. Wiley noted, we get one chance to do this right and give our patients a good outcome. And so we think it's important to do everything in our power to make it as safe for them as possible.
If somebody's an addictive smoker and they come to see you the day of the surgery and they've smoked that day, what happens?
Well, what happens is their blood vessels at the site of the surgery constrict. And so they're less able to fight infection there, and they're less able to heal that wound. And for that reason, we've encouraged patients to stop smoking at least a month before surgery.
And Dr. Deanna, is it the smoke itself, the fumes of the smoke, or the nicotine, or how? What about patients using nicotine patches or gum, or how is that an effective?
That's a great question. And so while the smoke does lead to the risk that we see in terms of their lung status with having anesthesia, the nicotine is what has been shown to affect the small blood vessels that are located at the site of the wound where we're trying to get that patient to heal. And so patients need to be free of nicotine for 4 weeks prior to surgery to give themselves the best odds of success with the surgery. We've had good luck with getting patients help in terms of quitting smoking, and in some ways their long-term health status improves far more from getting them to quit smoking than it does from the surgery that they're about to have. I think the same is true with patients who lose significant weight, you know, over 50 pounds to have their surgery. They notice a dramatic increase in their quality of life from the surgery itself, but also from the health choices they've made to get to the point prior to surgery.
Excellent. Dr. Fox, can you talk to us about daily alcohol use?
Well, daily alcohol use is clearly an issue in terms of just A, cooperation with the physical therapy, which is a critical aspect of the postoperative care, the risk that you may fall. I always kind of sign off people in the hospital, thou shall be no falling, because I think that's one of the major problems that we see postoperatively. And I think that I think those are two enormous parts of it. And then the nutritional part of it. We talked about malnutrition and obesity. Well, clearly we see the same thing with alcohol use as well. So those three key points are very important.
Okay. Does the alcohol use affect healing at all?
I don't believe it does, but from a nutritional standpoint, the profile that you have from a nutritional standpoint does.
Okay. And it's an open question to all of you, just in terms of, you know, how patients live. Like, they need to have some support after the surgery, you know. So, you know, what about patients who live alone and don't have a lot of support, or if they're not necessarily in a safe situation at home? What are some of the things that we can do to modify those risk factors?
I think patients need to have somebody to act as their coach after surgery. So it's very important for them to identify a support person that may not live with them, but can either stay with them for a couple days or check on them frequently to make sure that they're successful with their outcomes and able to negotiate their recovery. That coach person should be with them throughout the process at all of their preoperative visits. They should be attending the preoperative education and pre-admission testing with the patient. It's very important that they have that support person available to assist them during that immediate recovery period, at least for the first week or so.
As Dr. Fox had mentioned earlier, this is major surgery, but the recovery from hip and knee replacements has dramatically become more... the recovery from total hip and total knee replacement has accelerated rapidly over the last number of years for a variety of reasons, not the least of which are anesthetic techniques with local anesthesias, nerve blocks, local anesthetic infiltration into the tissues like a dentist would before he had dental work. The medications that we use now focusing more on non-opioid medicine to lessen side effects of constipation and confusion that can come with opioid medication. So patients in the hospital are typically feeling very well immediately after surgery. Patients are up walking right away. We have patients use some supports for balance so they don't fall, as Dr. Fox mentioned. So the vast, vast majority of patients we expect to go home after surgery. Even patients who live alone in the right setting can go home if they have single floor living, just a couple steps to get into the house. And often in those situations, on a case-by-case basis, we may have some visiting nurses or home therapists come to the house to assist. So patients are not sent home to fend for themselves necessarily, but it's very important, as Vicki mentioned, to have someone that you trust who can check in on you, perhaps be with you, perhaps stay with a family member or have them stay with you for a day or two, at least the night of discharge. This, we don't anticipate that someone would need to be with them for a month or probably even a week, but just for the first couple days or day or two can be quite helpful.
All right, great.
Because we emphasize the fact that there's a lot of mythology about the both the opioids and the rehabilitation. We're spending a great deal of time educating the patients and the families about the fact that, you know, you don't need to go to rehab. That and think of it in terms of functionally, within days, you'll be better in, at the site that you live in than you were before the surgery, and you managed at home before the surgery. So it really is an educational kind of philosophy where people somehow have this feeling, well, I'm going to be laid up for 6 weeks. And those days are over for the reasons that Dr. Wiley has pointed out from a standpoint of pain control. We've clearly seen the patients do far better without long-term narcotic usage. And that's part of the educational aspect of it also. People have this preconceived idea they have to have their narcotics after the surgery, and that simply isn't the case.
At this point, Ron, many of our patients are going home the same day, able to do stairs in the hospital safely. Before they go home. And so while it is important to have someone available to help if needed for a few days, patients are becoming fairly mobile pretty quickly these days.
And as Dr. Dion mentioned, more and more patients are going home the same day. Not everyone. It's a case-by-case basis. That's not for everyone. But more and more over the coming years, we'll see that become more the norm than the exception, I think. And Dr. Fox has a good term I've heard him say before, that it's always best to be in your own home where your own bacteria know you. again, to limit the risk of infection that we talked about. And along the lines of pain medication, you know, patients frequently will say, well, Tylenol doesn't work for me, or an anti-inflammatory doesn't work for me. Well, it certainly doesn't work if you don't take it. So, you know, we have patients go home on a scheduled regimen of Tylenol 3 times a day, typically an anti-inflammatory as well, and often a non-opioid medicine for nerve pain as well. And this combination really helps limit the need for narcotics, opioids, and the side effects that come with them.
Great. Now, what would you say is the top thing a patient can do to help them to have, be successful in having these procedures?
I think that, Ron, I think the top thing that patients can do to be successful is realize that they have to be invested in the process. What Dr. Dion, Dr. Fox, and Dr.
Myself.
What Dr. Dion, Dr. Fox, and I can do, we do over a very limited time frame during the surgery. But they can do all these things to address their general health beforehand, have things arranged for a successful and safe recovery afterwards, and that's the best thing that patients can do to ensure as good a recovery as possible and lessen the risks associated with it. What we do over a very focused, short time frame, but ultimately the patient really has to take an active role to have the best outcome.
I often tell people, you know, get your preoperative condition where it needs to be. And that's just not physically, but from an emotional standpoint, from the weight standpoint, optimize every aspect of your condition. And people say, well, can I go to PT before the surgery? Well, yeah, you can, but that's a very small piece of it. You know, I tell people to exercise to the extent, don't make it hurt more before the surgery. No pain, no gain doesn't apply before the surgery, but it may after the surgery. But keep your weight in check. And the smoking that we've talked about. Maximize the nutrition and maximize the condition that you live in at home. Because, you know, like I said, my first statement was this is major surgery. And it is, but it's one of the more wonderfully successful ones too. But they have to be invested to ensure success.
I agree completely with what's been said. I think patients who have the right attitude are the ones who benefit most from this surgery. I often tell patients that my part's only half of the process, and their part is the other half. And so, having trust in the system, you know, we do this over 1,000 times a year here, and so we've seen a lot of what works and what maybe doesn't work as well. And so patients who do go along with our system and comply with the plan tend to be happier in the long term.
Great, thank you. So, Vicki, if a patient has a question after they've had surgery, is there a specific number that they can call?
Yes, they can call our office, which or they can call my office. My phone number is 603-724-2353, and I would be happy to answer any questions that a patient might have.
Okay, great.
Ron, so I think we need to understand as well that although these are major surgeries, they're typically very, very successful surgeries. There was a study that suggested that cataract surgery and total joint replacement were the surgeries that provided the most patient satisfaction out of all the surgical or medical procedures. So we're talking a lot about, you know, things that can go wrong. When that happens is a very, very small percentage of time, about 1% historically in our practice with a major infection. But we want to do everything that we can to try to get that number to zero. And so, because they are, when they do happen, although unusual, they're major events.
Great. Well, I think this is going to be a great resource for patients. I want to thank you all for participating.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.